And so we're backtracking today to look at the Gospels and women's role in the Gospels as Jesus defines it. We're going to backtrack from that a little bit, though. Not a little bit. We're going to go back to the beginning, to the first three chapters of Genesis, because I think a lot of who we understand ourselves to be as Christian men and women comes from how we understand ourselves as God created us. And that has a great influence then on how we read the Gospels, and another time how you get into Paul and how you read Paul, because although Jesus doesn't refer to, he talks about the creation briefly a couple of points, never talks about the fall, but St. Paul does make several references, especially when he's talking about women, to that third chapter in Genesis, and occasionally allusions to the creation as it's told in the second chapter of Genesis. So we'll get a little perspective on that today. Because of some time limits, I think I'll talk a little bit about the Genesis to give you some background and a little bit of background on women in Jesus' time, the position of women in the culture and in the religious life. And then we'll talk about four specific gospel stories that I've put on the board. These are not going to exhaust the gospel stories about women at all. I've been excited by John's going into Luke today. If you read any of the Gospels, you see very quickly that Luke lifts up so many stories about women. It's an exciting one to read from that perspective alone. John's been mentioning the parallels also in those first two or three chapters, and Luke does a lot with parallels involving women and men. Very often in his Gospel you'll find something that happens to a man, a healing, or some kind of contact with Jesus, and either immediately before or after or within a very few verses, there's a parallel example of that same kind of incident happening with a woman in Jesus' life. So it's an exciting gospel to work with, but we're going to jump around and do four different stories in three of the gospels this afternoon, and we'll do those in some small group discussions so that we have a chance to talk some variety. I want to just mention, for those who are interested, I have a bibliography up here. I have a few copies left, and more would be available if we need them. Biblical feminist references that some friends and I have found helpful and useful for study. There's nothing on a social issue there. It's strictly as it relates to study of scripture on the issue of women and women's roles or rights or position or however you would interpret that. Let's begin with Genesis. Just to start at the beginning. Approaching the first three chapters of Genesis can be very complex. There are lots of different ways of looking at it. One of the most helpful for me, and that I'll just use for kind of a format today, some commentaries suggest that the first three chapters of Genesis are really trying to answer three different questions. The first question, basically, how did the world begin? The second question basically is, what's the relationship that God intended between men and women? And the third question is, how did the world get in the mess that we're in? If we look at Genesis 1, in the beginning God, which brings us to Paul's comment earlier, which was the first woman in the Bible, he was very serious. The Hebrew word for God in the first Genesis account is Elohim, E-L-O-H-I-M. The first part of that, E-L-O-H, is a feminine plural Hebrew word. The I-M is a masculine plural ending. So in the first four words of our scriptures, we have a picture of a God, if we understood it as a Hebrew, one whole God who encompasses men and women, masculine and feminine qualities. Well, that's kind of exciting. Not two gods, not multiple gods, but one God. Who is both feminine and masculine. The first Genesis account, most of you know, is a later tradition. A lot of commentaries have suggested that possibly one of the reasons that it was written was to counter some of the religious ideologies that surrounded the people, the Israelites at this time. Some of the early myths of the creation and some of the like Mesopotamian myths, the Eastern cultures, suggest things like wars between all the gods. And as hair flew and spears and stuff went flying around, one of the things that happened was that worlds were created. People happened. All of this very accidental kind of a spewing that just sort of happened without any planning and intention. And the Israelites wanted to say to those cultures, no, one God, created all of this that we see with purpose and with intention. And so they talk about, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. As you read through this story, you see it's a nice, linear, orderly description, beginning with the very most simple elements, the separation of lightness and dark, and progressing through the animals and the fish and the plants, until finally you get to the culmination, the creation of human beings, in verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image." The Hebrew word here is Adam, A-D-H-A-M. We translate that Adam later out. What's important in that word, again, as we found with the Elohim, is an understanding of who that refers to. Adam in Hebrew is a generic word meaning what we would say humankind, people. It is not talking about male and female. It's one inclusive term that says that this humankind that God created is both, not just a male human being. We can see that very quickly in verse 27. So God created Adam, humankind, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female created he them. There's the first gender terms in Genesis. Up until then, we've got this one term that refers to all of humankind. They were both created simultaneously. That's different from the second Genesis account. They were both at the same time given dominion, it says in verse 26. And God blessed them and said, finally, be fruitful and multiply. The same gift was given to both, to the Adam, to the whole humankind. When we move into the second Genesis account, we actually are moving backward in time to an older tradition, a more primitive tradition. If you were reading Hebrew, you'd see it very quickly. Beginning in verse 4, in that day the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. We've got Yahweh instead of Elohim here. A different understanding of God. This is more in the line of the patriarchal God that we find more clearly throughout the Old Testament. We have a different structure to this. We don't go in a nice orderly pattern from the simplest to the most complex. We begin with a creation of an area in the garden, and then we put a man in there. And then after that, we get all the animals created, and finally, the woman. In Hebrew literature, this is a fairly common literary technique. Rather than a nice linear one that progresses from the beginning to the end, there's kind of a ring structure in which the very first statement and the very last statement are of equal weight and importance. When we begin to understand that, and then we talk about Adam, all the animals around in the circle, and finally Eve, we're not talking about a linear, hierarchical sort of structure. And I think that's important because I think it's necessary for us to understand that as the creation. There is no hierarchy. It's rather a talking of a complementarity, an equality, if you will, between the man and the woman. After God has put man in the garden, to back up a wee bit, he says, "It's not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." I think the King James uses a helpmeet fit for him. We lose a lot in the translation on this word. I'm going to give you a little more Hebrew. The Hebrew word for helpmeet or helper fit for him is two words. The first word is ezer, E-Z-E-R. The second word is neged, N-E-G-E-D. Neged is a proposition that would translate as that which is suitable for or appropriate to. It's a connector. The word ezer is used 21 times in the Old Testament, just for a little statistical information. 16 times the reference is to a helper greater than, of more importance than, of more power than, a superordinate, if you would, helper. One very familiar passage, Psalm 121, I look to the hills from whence comes my help. My help comes from the Lord. The word help there is Ezer. Obviously, a help that is greater than humankind. The other references are talking in terms of an equal relationship. I can't tell you exactly where it is. It references something about don't trust to the help of princes or other men. They don't have the power, in other words. But it's talking about equals. You know, don't look for help there. The only time we could translate the word Ezer to mean a subordinate is if we suddenly, in this one passage of Genesis, read it that way. I think very often we have read it as subordinate. I will make a helper fit for you. We read in terms of assistant. The doctor's assistant is someone who's not really a doctor. The assistant to the president of the college is someone who's not quite the president, but is maybe close. That is not biblical. That does not square with what the Genesis account is saying. So we don't have God saying, I'm going to give you an assistant. We have God saying, I'm going to find someone who is suitable for you, appropriate to you, and equal to you. Adam's response, wow, when he finally sees the woman. There's somebody like me. I can't really have a relationship with the lions. This anteater and I can't really get it on together. But here's somebody like me, the same qualities, the same kind of being. So it's a very excited response that we see when Adam says, this at last. You know, we waded through all these other creatures, but finally, we've got someone who's like me, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. The next verse slipped by me until about 2 years ago. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. In the patriarchal culture, who left the family? When the woman. What Genesis says, you know. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that the Genesis writer is saying that we want to change the family structure, but I think it's sort of suggesting that it's a totally new relationship. Both are going. We're getting something new, something different here. That's exciting. I think the picture that creation gives us is one that we need to keep in mind as we work through the fall and get to the Gospels. Okay. There's a lot of talk today about an order of creation. I think most of us have heard the phrase used. I look at that term and I would say if we're talking of order as differentiated from confusion, I would fully agree. I think the first two chapters of Genesis show us very clearly a God of order, a God who purposefully and carefully and intentionally creates. If we're talking about the first two chapters of Genesis showing an order of creation that is based on a hierarchy, I don't find it there. I don't find it at all. When we move into the third chapter of Genesis, where the fun begins, the serpent was the more subtle or more wily than any other creature. He talks to the woman. Why he approached the woman, I don't know. There are all kinds of plays being done on what happens there. Some say because she would talk theology with him and discuss it with him and it was challenging and exciting. I don't know. I'm not sure that any of that would hold water. I'm not sure that that's the issue that the Genesis writer is lifting up. What I do think he's saying is that something happened and both with some wrestling, the woman it shows wrestling with the issue more than the man, but with some struggle, finally makes the decision in full consciousness to disobey, to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Until both have eaten, though, nothing is said. We can't really look at that and claim that, you know, Eve fell and brought Adam down, or that, if only Eve hadn't, then Adam wouldn't, because it says that they both made that decision. And the results were that both eyes were opened and alienation began. The contrast that we see at that point from the first two chapters of Genesis through the rest of that chapter particularly and in the history of the Old Testament are very, very marked. in the next few verses, there is suddenly, it says, first of all, they knew they were naked. I read that as suddenly being vulnerable to each other and unable to be vulnerable anymore because there's a power struggle. They sewed fig leaves. They covered themselves up. They protected themselves, walled themselves off. They reinforced the alienation. And when the judgment is discussed in the next few verses, it's discussed in terms of alienation from each other, alienation from God. You know, the first time the word fear is mentioned is after the fall. God was walking in the garden and they hid because they were afraid. Alienation from nature. All of a sudden, this beautiful Garden of Eden, in sweat you shall earn the bread, in pain you shall bear children. There's this alienation from nature. All of this happens to both of them. Bonhoeffer is to me a powerful quote. He says, Eve only falls totally when Adam falls, for the two are one. In their guilt too, they are two and yet one. They fall together as one, and each carries all the guilt alone. Male and female, he created them, and man fell away from him, male and female. There's no separation there. The judgment that we see then in those next few verses, often read as the curse, I would like us to think of it in terms of judgment. I think that describes more accurately what's happening. I think we've often, most often read it as God saying kind of, now I gotcha. You know, now you're going to suffer. How many of us have done that to our kids? Now I caught you with your hand in the cookie jar. Now you're going to get it. Instead, if we change our attitude in reading that, to not God prescribing now how the world is going to be, but God saying, oh, you guys, why'd you have to do it? Look what you did. Now you've gone, and because you can't be honest with each other anymore, there's going to be a power struggle. You've broken your relationship with nature. Instead of being sensitive to the skies, you're going to pollute it just because you're being selfish. That's not what I wanted, but look what you've gone ahead and done. Kind of a description of what we've chosen. If I insist on always having my own way, I'm not going to have many friends. That's not God prescribing. That's God saying, you know, that's the way it's going to be if you choose to act like that. If you choose to disobey, there's going to be break in relationship. If you insist on always doing it your way, it's going to be hard to get along with you. I think that's what's happening after the fall when God comes into the garden and after they finally face him. Did you notice what happens when they finally face him? God says, did you do what I told you not to do? And what's Adam say? She made me do it. Even worse, how does he preface it?
The woman now gave it.
The woman you gave me. He's blaming God. I mean, he's really spewing. He's going to get everybody. What's he say? The snake made me do it. He's sort of the buck stops here with the snake, that poor little creature. But isn't that what we do? You know, when somebody says, why did you do it? Isn't our first reaction, I didn't do anything. Yeah. It's happening right there. You know, it's dishonesty. It's blaming the other one. There's alienation, if nothing else. I think that's a perfect description of what the fall is. In the midst of that, as God is saying, you know, look what you've chosen for yourself. Look what you have taken. He promises right at the beginning, though, redemption and restoration. In that powerful passage, he will bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. Enmity between you and the woman. Right away, God's saying, you know, somehow we're going to restore this. Restore to me means go back to the way God intended the creation to be. The restoration, which begins as God sends them out of Eden, he makes clothing for them. It's really God saying, you know, I'm still not leaving you alone. You've blown it, but I'm going to give you some more clothing. And then he sends them out with this promise of restoration, of newness, of the creation as it was intended to be. And if we skip about 1,000 years in history, we come to the birth of our Lord, which is the fulfillment of time, that Kairos moment that Paul kept talking, Paul we talked about so much last week, of the beginning of the redemption and restoration. Let me sort of bring you up to where women were in that time. Israel had moved from a nomadic community to a much more stable community by the time of Jesus, which generally served to restrict women in particular more. A lot more laws were finely defined. The Ten Commandments had been refined to, I don't remember how many hundreds of details. Keeping the Sabbath meant you could walk 29 steps but not 30, because 30 was breaking it, because that was work. And then there were all kinds of details and ways to avoid it. So there were some very restrictive rules and regulations by this time. Women were seen in one of two roles primarily, either as wives and mothers or as the temptress, the seductress. Obviously the only acceptable role is that of wife and mother. And it wasn't as bad as we want to make it sound sometimes. I don't want us to do that lightly. In that culture, a woman in the role of wife and mother, there was some respect in for her, and there was some protection for her. Attitudinally, though, the attitudes that had developed by then, especially among the rabbinic traditions, were extremely harsh on women. You'll find no outright contempt for women in the Old Testament, but you find it blatantly in the rabbinic writings by that time. Just a few examples. It's better to burn the scriptures than to have them in the hands of a woman. When a boy comes into the world, peace comes into the world. When a girl comes, nothing comes. Even the most virtuous of women is a witch. Better a man's wickedness than a woman's goodness. And then the real crowning point. Every day a devout Jewish man prayed, I praise you, God, that you did not make me a slave. I praise you, God, that you did not make me a Gentile. I praise you, God, that you did not make me a woman. That put for me, when I suddenly started connecting that up with Paul's Galatians statement, all he does is turn that around, which is really exciting. But Paul hadn't written that marvelous statement at the time of Jesus. And most scholars feel that by Jesus' time, the status of women in the culture had never been lower, and quite possibly never has been lower. Legally, women were always minors, always the equivalent of children. They could make no vows, no religious vows, unless they were approved by their husband or father or brother, whoever was the male caretaker for them. They were always dependent on a man in charge of them. As a girl, it would be a father or her brother if her father were dead, her husband. If she were a widow, her husband's brother. No legal responsibility on her own. She could not be a witness in court. I think this was both because she was legally a minor, but also because the contempt of women said that they always lied, you couldn't trust them anyway. So she could not be a legal witness in any kind of court action. Women could not own property. Women could not get divorced, as opposed to a man who could get a divorce if his wife burned to suffer. Or when we talked about Paul last week and the issue of veiling, some of the writings said that if a Jewish woman married Jewish woman went out of the house without her veil, her husband was told he must divorce her. In that culture, she had sort of said that she was a prostitute or the equivalent of. But on that basis, he was to divorce her. No way a woman could get a divorce. Religiously, there was very limited participation in the religious life of the community. A woman was not obligated to morning prayers or table grace, as all men were. A woman could not be counted towards the necessary quorum to have a religious service, to make the congregation. Neither could children, neither could slaves. Sort of lumped them all together. A woman was not allowed to study scripture. Could not discuss theology, because if you didn't study scripture, you didn't know theology. A woman was never spoken to in public. The rabbis wouldn't even talk to their own wives in public. Lots of comments about don't even speak to your own wife lest someone should start gossiping, lest men should be offended. What does that say about your position as a woman if you can't even greet your own husband as you pass him on the street? There were extremely detailed laws on uncleanness, which applied to both men and women, but more harshly to women. The taboos, particularly concerning any flow of blood, were extremely harsh. For a woman, during your menstrual period and 1 week afterwards, you were unclean. You were told very clearly you were dirty, you were filthy, you were soiled. You could not come in contact with people, you were isolated, emotionally as well as physically. If you figure at least a week plus the week afterwards, you're there's half a month, all the way from puberty through menopause, half of your life, except when you were pregnant. If that isn't bad enough, at the end of that time you made a sin offering at the temple before you were back as part of the community. A male with any kind of natural emission, bodily emission, was unclean, but only till evening. Women, it went on a long time. After childbirth, you were unclean for 7 days if you had a boy child, but 14 days if you had a girl child. And the period of purification was 33 days after the birth of a male child and 66 days after the birth of a female child, followed again by that sin offering that you brought to the temple. You know, just think of what that's saying to you as a woman with this natural bodily function. It wasn't understood, and so the writings against it were just harsh. And what that must have said to women and what they must have felt about themselves during that time. Giving you a lot of just loose information. I'm going to ask you to do something with it very briefly. Our hour is half gone. I'll ask you to break into about four discussion groups, maybe one, two, we'll better make four down here, and then maybe a couple on the top, and we'll just repeat these again, and we can sort of feed in together. If you'll pull your chairs around in a circle, what I'm going to ask you to do is group one, take Mark 5, 25 to 34 over here. Group two, Luke 10, 38 to 42. Group 3, John 4, 5 to 30 and 39 to 42. It's a long passage, but just breeze through it as fast as I can. John 11 for group 4, 17 to 27. Will you read that passage quickly together and then see if, as a Jewish woman in Jesus' day, something that's going on in there speaks surprisingly to you, shockingly. How do you read that now? Let's say 1, 2. Make you 3. Maybe you can pull some more in there, or just get it to the group so that you can talk about this story together. Okay. There's a lot of animated discussion going on. I think there were a lot of ahas happening. That's what I was hoping for. Let's start with the Mark story, which is one of my favorites. I don't know if you're using Bibles that are cross-referenced, but this story in Mark, the same story appears in Matthew and Luke. So the fact that all three synoptic Gospels note it, I think is an extremely significant story. Would you like to tell us what you found in that? Any of you, see, group one was up there also, right? Maybe if you'll just start talking about some of the things that you found and you add in, okay?
Whenever I've read this, I've related that to someone now who has a disease for 12 years, but now, like we talked about what that meant socially to her, that just increases her suffering that much more. And also, according to what you said, she shouldn't have even been at that gathering. She should have been, you know, concealing herself, and that makes her step out in faith that much more bold.
Mm-hmm.
To have even been there.
The punishment for her purposely going in and defiling all those people that she touched getting through the crowd was potentially stoning to death. What else in that story? I'm sorry, maybe we should just very quickly summarize what the story is because the other groups don't know what you've read. This is the story of the woman with the flow of blood in Mark's gospel who had the flow of blood for 12 years. Mark mentions that she'd been to lots of doctors and hadn't been cured. Luke, who was the doctor, doesn't mention that she'd seen lots of doctors. Luke does mention, though, something else. This in Mark's gospel, it says, she came through the crowd, and she said, if I just touch his hem, I know I'll be healed. And so she snuck through the crowd. She did. She was healed, but Jesus called attention to it after the healing had already taken place and publicly called her to task. Luke mentions that she came and confessed in the presence of all the people, had to publicly admit that she had touched and made unclean all those people. Imagine the crowd's reaction. Oof. What else did you find in there?
What Jesus' reaction to her wasn't that, what are you doing out here in public? What are you doing here? Doesn't even mention it. He just wants to know who touched me.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't say, you're forgiven for some horrible sin that you did that made you believe for 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As daughter. Extremely powerful language. We miss that. Yeah, really touching. He doesn't mention that he's going to go cleanse himself, you notice. He's not going to go through any ritual bathing because he's been touched. What does that say to the crowd? He lets it be known very publicly that this woman, this unclean woman, touched a bunch of people and touched the rabbi. But he doesn't address that issue. What is he saying to the crowd then? He's addressing her faith. Yeah.
What I'm thinking is not what he's saying to the crowd, but what the crowd is thinking about him, whom they don't trust anyway. Because here's a person who's defying Jewish law by not chastising her for doing something if that was,
okay.
You follow what I say?
Okay, he should be chastising her. You're right. That's what they would expect.
Well,
when he doesn't do that, though, they have to start saying, well, gee, what's he really done?
I wonder if they did, or if they just said, well, this just proves that he can't be what he says he is, because if he was, he would be following Jewish law.
I'm sure a lot left him because of that, because he frequently did things like this. Mm-hmm. He touched people who were unclean. There's a lot of Jesus touching in the Gospels, lepers and unclean people, and healing of demoniacs and by touching, healing of blind people. He uses that a lot.
On the other hand, I was going to say that this would put some people in awe of him.
Mm-hmm.
He did this, and they stepped back and had mixed emotions with that.
What he may have been teaching very well by not saying anything is no more of these crazy laws.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't count. We don't even bother with uncleanness anymore. It is not an issue. That just ends, a couple of chapters of Leviticus, for starters, in addition to all the rabbinic commentary that had been piled on top of it. But a powerful lesson. He talks to her, he calls her to public accounting, he has her talk to him, deal with him, and even in her fear, she's able to do it. And what an affirming gesture, what an affirming thing he says. Your faith has made you whole. We miss that word. Wholeness, not just the physical healing, but she's a person again. She's been talked to as a real person, not as this thing that ought to be kept out of sight. That's an exciting word to me. I think that's one of the most exciting words in the gospel. Your faith has made you whole.
What term? We don't have that much. In RSV, it's well.
I think the word would translate out as whole also.
Well.
I, Let me see if it does in one of the other versions. The Jerusalem says your faith has restored you to health. Your faith has cured you in New English. The King James is interesting. Go in peace and be whole of thy plague. I think probably if we were to use the Hebrew word shalom, we would come closer to understanding what that meant, especially in light of the fact that it affirmed her as a person, not just as a physically healed being. Okay. Anything more on the Mark story? Okay, let's move on to, let's skip down to John for a minute. We'll come back to Mary Martha's. The Samaritan woman at the well. Jesus is going through the town of Samaria. Is that this group okay? Mm-hmm. Which is enemy territory. Normally the Jews wouldn't even speak to the Samaritans. Which begins to give some impact to the story of the Good Samaritan. He stops, the disciples go into town to look for some food. He's sitting by a well, a woman comes out to get some water. She's coming in the middle of the day, which suggests she's probably isolated from the community. And as we discover a little more about her, we can see why she's not one of the elite of the community. But Jesus says, I'd like a drink of water. And they get into conversation and some important things happen. Well, whoever did number three, talk a little bit about that one. Okay.
One thing that struck me was that Jesus said, give me a drink. You know, when I first read it, and if you don't go on after that, it's like he's ordering her, you, give me a drink. You know, that he, you know, I'm above you and I can order you to give me a drink. But as you go on in the conversation between Jesus and the woman, and that even though, you know, she is a prostitute or she's living in sin and et cetera, he will lower himself to take a drink from a cup that she has put into the well, or
where did you read that he would lower himself in the gospel?
No, I didn't. I just
okay.
was saying that okay. could be one way you could interpret it.
All right.
That he's saying that he would take a drink from an unclean woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he would accept water from her out
okay.
of the well. You know, that's kind of lifting her up.
Okay.
Or,
okay, I see what you're saying.
You know, like that. And
doesn't talk about lowering himself.
No.
Though.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. And how she wants to. It also impressed me in verse 15. I can't remember exactly what it says.
He has just said to her, whoever drinks this water will be thirsty again, but anyone who drinks the water that I shall give will never be thirsty again. And she says, give me some of that water so I may never get thirsty
yeah.
and never have to come here again.
Is that perhaps, you know, she sees herself as being not an elite person, and
mm-hmm.
maybe by getting this kind of water, it can help her status and can lift her up. And then in verse 27, where it says the disciples marveled that he was talking to a woman. Like,
it should have
oh
been
my
more
gosh.
Shocking. Yeah, right. It should have been more shocking that he was talking to a Samaritan.
Yeah.
But they're just aghast that he's talking to a woman
yeah.
in public.
It's like they might walk back and wait till he was done talking, or
yeah.
before they went back up to him and said, we're back.
Yeah, they don't even ask him about it. Did you notice that? They haven't quite got the nerve to say, what are you doing? It just says they thought it. They wondered. Okay, so he's talking to a woman in a very public place.
Mm-hmm.
She recognizes that the water that he's talking about is special.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of a discussion do they get into then?
Well, they talk a little bit about her life, you know,
mm-hmm.
her status. And
mm-hmm.
he tells her that he's the Christ.
Uh-huh. First revelation in the Gospels, where Jesus clearly says that he is Messiah. He rarely says that in the Gospels. You know, who do you say I am? He'll have other people try to define him, and he'll agree or approve what Peter said, you are the Christ. But rarely does Jesus come out with, clearly, I am the Messiah. We're going to look at two of those incidences today, because both of them happened to be to a woman. In a day when you didn't talk to women, you especially didn't talk to women about theology, and yet that's the kind of discussion they're having. You know, where will we worship God? She's talking about it. Apparently Samaritan women had a little bit better position than the Israelite women. But he's discussing all of these issues with her, and then reveals himself, I who am speaking to you, I'm he. Can you imagine being that woman? Wow, that's exciting. Then she goes home to tell other people, and they come back because someone jokingly said she was the first missionary for Jesus. And she went back to the village, and they came out on her say-so. But then later on it says, finally after they'd listened to him for a couple of days, they told her, well, we first believed because you said, but now we don't have to believe you anymore because we've seen him for ourselves. So they finally feel they have it straight. But all the things that Jesus is violating there, it's amazing in the context of that time. The witness thing, you can think also of Easter Sunday morning. Who were the first people at the tomb? The women. And when they went and told the other disciples, what was the first reaction? Didn't believe it. You know, Jesus is doing some very, very radical things here, not only by telling women these very important things, but by saying, go and tell others. He often says, don't tell them who I am, but to the women with these important messages, he says, go and tell. Go and witness to me. So he is just countering all the things that are expected and allowed for women in that day. Okay. Let's back up into Mary and Martha in the Luke story. This is probably one that you've all grown up on, right? Mary and Martha and Bethany. Jesus comes to their home with the disciples. Martha's stuck in the kitchen cooking. Mary's sitting around just listening. And Martha gets irritated. I think we've all experienced that. It's no fun to be out in the kitchen when there's a really good discussion going on in the living room. And she says something about it, and Jesus talks to her about it. Who was doing that? Okay, how about sharing with us what you discovered in there?
Well, he makes it okay for her to sit and discuss theology. It's fine. You don't always have to be in
the Mary was sitting.
You don't always have to be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You can ignore that part of it.
He affirmed Mary very much. Sitting and discussing, listening, learning in a day when that was not acceptable. That she could choose that. That she had the right to make those decisions and those choices for herself. Does he put Martha down? He says maybe she needs to reexamine some priorities at that moment, which is a word to all of us in all times, I think. But he doesn't say, forget the kitchen. I've kind of had a fantasy sometimes when I've thought about this story that probably what would have been more likely is he would have said, bring your carrots that need grating and we'll all stand around in the kitchen, we'll all talk together and grate the carrots and peel the potatoes and get the dinner going. Because he was probably hungry. They'd been traveling. And he didn't say, we don't need to eat and drink. But he might have said to her, we don't need a 17-course feast. Some crackers and cheese will do it, thank you. And then we could all visit. So it serves rather than as a put-down to Martha, as a, I think, a reminder to us about some priorities. But he really does affirm Mary in a role that was not acceptable in that culture. Anything more on that one? Such a brief story, but it's such a delightful one. Okay, move on to the last one, the John. Again, we have the same Mary and Martha, good friends of Jesus. The relationship is obviously very close by the kinds of talking that they do with one another. In this story, it's just after Lazarus' death, for those who've not read it, and Jesus has come, and Martha goes out to meet him. This time Mary stays back at the house. And she says, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. You can read that lots of ways. A lot of people say it's kind of a pleading, a recognition of Jesus' power. Some people have said she's really angry. You know, you could have prevented this from happening. I don't know. Choose how you will. I think what happens after that is what's really critical. Talk with us about what you found.
Okay, I don't know if this is going to talk, so I've written down a few things and maybe the rest
good.
One thing that I think is important is that they have had a relationship prior to this, so she probably felt more comfortable and relaxed around him. But because she went out to meet him, we're not supposed to be said talk to him on the street, which was a very bold move, and the fact that he accepted and recognized her. And again, asked her, he said, "I am the resurrection and life," and asked her, "Do you believe this?" And she said, "Yes." And he asked, that's a theological question. He's asking her, he's discussing theology and what third. I liked his response, and that he didn't feel threatened or challenged or defensive by her. It was a real warm statement, and he treated her as more than equal.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't say, you know, we can't discuss this here, or you know, or why are you questioning my authority?
Mm-hmm.
It was just responding to her on a real human level.
Yes, very different. Anything more?
We thought it was kind of strange, too, that Mary stayed at home, and we had the Mary and Martha reversed. We thought that it was the same one that had listened that went out, and when we found it was the other.
Yeah.
Now we can't, now we're not.
Right.
You
can't put clear roles on them.
Right.
I think that's kind of neat.
That's very human, too.
Yeah.
And also
maybe
that she learned from his statement to her that, you know, there are other things that besides the cooking,
mm-hmm.
and that it's interesting that she was the one that went out to meet him.
Yeah.
While Mary stayed at home.
Yes. That declaration, I don't want us to skim over that too quickly. I am the resurrection and the life. One of the most powerful images we have of our Lord. And again, one of those very direct I am statements to a woman. And he doesn't say, don't tell anybody. He tells her. And you have to assume that something neat like that, she's going to tell somebody else.
Yeah.
The story continues with the resurrection of Lazarus. Some of the reality of the gospel comes in there. I just love the King James Version. When they get to the grave and he says, you know, open, roll the stone away and open the grave. And she said, but it's been 4 days. And the King James says, he will stink up. But, you know, that real note of fact in there. There are two other resurrection accounts in the gospel that are important, because there are only three times when Jesus actually raises someone from the dead. And all three of them have to do with a woman. Lazarus, because the sisters are very close friends, and they asked, you know, this wouldn't have happened if you had been here. You could have saved him. There was a friendship there for sure. The second one, Jairus' daughter, which is in the middle of the woman with the flow of blood, in all three synoptics again. Jesus is on his way to Jairus' house, the authority, the ruler's house, the daughter has died, but Jesus raises her from the dead. And the third one, with the son of the widow of Nain, in Luke's gospel, where Jesus saw her crying, and it begins to sound from the way that the account is written that she probably was going to be alone. And a widow in those days with no children or family to support her was really in a precarious position. And it says Jesus saw her and had compassion on her, and he raised her son. The only time touching a dead body was another one of the unclean rules. The only time Jesus actually touched a dead person was with Jairus' daughter. So he kind of violated two rules in one. Sort of like, we'll just do a nice fell swoop and let it be known that not only touching a woman, but touching a dead woman, the unclean rules again, they just don't count. He didn't touch either Lazarus. He called to Lazarus and he called to the widow's son. Some more in there. There are other references in the Gospels. I'll just whip through really quickly, and then it's about time for the first dinner bell to ring, and those who would like to stay after and talk some more about them will stay around, and those who are hungry can go to first setting. Many healings mentioned, again particularly in Luke's Gospel. There's a marvelous story of a woman who has been crippled, bent over for 18 years. that you could very simply, if we have time at the end, I'll take you through that story in a neat little experience way that was done at a conference I went to recently. He heals Peter's mother-in-law, and I mentioned Jairus' daughter. So there are many times when he touches women and heals them, in addition to the woman with the flow of blood. Luke especially mentions many women as followers and disciples of Jesus. It says that many ministered to Jesus. In the Greek, the word there for minister is diakonon, which is translated in some versions as provided for. Many people, many of the women provided for Jesus out of their own pockets. Mark says many women ministered to Jesus. It's the same word that when Paul uses it in reference to deacons in his letters, the deacons of the church, the work of ministering. Adulterous woman, the woman taken in adultery, Jesus very clearly says there are no double standards. If both were caught, it's only the woman brought. Jesus does not judge her and condemn her. His both actually were, would be eligible for stoning again by the laws of that day, but he raises the question, whoever's without sin, cast the first stone, and then says, did no one condemn you? And she says, no one, Lord. And he says, then neither will I. Go and sin no more. He doesn't affirm the sin, but he says, he affirms her as a person who, you know, we're not going to play any more double standards of bringing the woman and not the man. The issue of divorce, in a time, as I mentioned, when men could get it but women could not, he said, both are capable, neither one have the moral right. His discussion on divorce in Matthew 19. No, neither should get the divorce, but he talks about it in very equal terms. He talks, when in one passage, someone praises his mother. Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that suckled you. And he says, that's not the standard in the kingdom. The standard in the kingdom is whoever hears and keeps God's word is my mother and my sister and my brother. So we're not going to say that women are good only because they can bear children, especially male children. But there's real affirmation of all who keep the word of God as being relatives. Parables. He talks about the nature of the kingdom being like a man planting mustard and a woman mixing yeast to make bread. He talks images that women would know, that would be very comfortable. On prayer, he gives a parable of the persistent woman and the unjust judge. He gives the contrast that with the publican and the Pharisee. And he's talking about readiness for the second coming. He gives a parable of the talents, the servants. And he also gives the parable of the wise and foolish maidens. Be ready. He talks about God in both masculine and feminine terms. We have three parables together that we always read the first and the third. The prodigal son, where the father is God. The good shepherd seeking for the lost sheep, where the shepherd is God. And right in the middle is the parable of the woman searching for the lost coin. Same emphasis. God searches out. He doesn't let the lost stay lost. In this case, she doesn't let the lost stay lost. I think Jesus is very clearly saying that, you know, you can't pin a sexual being on God. So he's very free to do that kind of thing that would have been very mind-boggling to most of the people in that day. This little book that I brought along called Jesus According to a Woman by Rachel Walberg is a delightful little book if you'd like to read some more on several, there are 8 or 10 accounts of Jesus and specific women. Some of them that we've done, some others that are in there. It's one of the books on that bibliography that I mentioned. I think it's very clear when we talk in terms of the order of creation, the fallen order, and the redeemed order or the restored order, that if we're not to deny Jesus' whole life and ministry and the death and resurrection, we cannot continue to function and say that the fallen order is the way God intends it. We created that fallen order. God has restored us to the created order. It's a restored order. It's a new order. Part of the crunch of living in between these times is that we can't always live it out. We are still more selfish than we are selfless. But the call of the gospel to all of us, to women and men, is to live that restored order, to know that we are all called to a wholeness, to be treated as people and to treat others as people, not on the basis of anything other than that God has created us purposefully, God has redeemed us, and God cares for us. The bell should ring, but we'll take time to talk if you'd like.